This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Good news for David Sedaris fans. He has a new collection of humorous personal essays called When You Are Engulfed in Flames. In an era when the number of people reading books seems to be dwindling, Sedaris is so popular he's become, excuse the expression, a brand. A Google search will lead you to people described as the David Sedaris of punk, the David Sedaris of graphic design, as well as the David Sedaris of wine writing, indie rock, hip-hop, knitting, Sweden, Israel, and Project Runway blogging. We have the real David Sedaris with us today, which I guess makes him the David Sedaris of David Sedaris, the one that is a regular contributor to public radio's This American Life and gets on the bestseller list each time he writes a book. Sedaris and his boyfriend, Yu, now divide their time between homes in France and England. David Sedaris, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's really great to talk with you again. As an ex-smoker myself, I have to ask you to start with your piece Smoking Section, which is all about how you started and how you stopped smoking. It's the longest piece in the book. I'm going to ask you to read a short section of it.
Sure. As with pot, it was astonishing how quickly I took to cigarettes. It was as if my life was a play and the prop mistress had finally showed up. Suddenly there were packs to unwrap, matches to strike, ashtrays to fill and then empty. My hands were at one with their labor, the way a cook's might be, or a knitter's. It's popular to believe that every smoker was brainwashed, sucked in by product placements and subliminal print ads. This argument comes in handy when you want to assign blame, but it discounts the fact that smoking is often wonderful. For people like me, people who twitched and jerked and cried out in tiny voices, cigarettes were a godsend. Not only that, but they tasted good, especially that first one in the morning and the seven or eight that immediately followed it. By late afternoon, after I'd finished a pack or so, I generally feel a heaviness in my lungs, especially in the 1980s when I worked with hazardous chemicals. I should have worn a respirator, but it interfered with my smoking, and so I set it aside.
That's David Sedaris reading from his new collection, which is called When You Are Engulfed in Flames. David, it's amazing to me that you stopped, you know, that you were able to do it. And, you know, when I'm thinking of all that you went through to get there, one of the things I think about is that your mother smoked, and you watched her wheeze, you watched her unable to do normal activities without, you know, without having serious difficulty breathing. Did that have an impact on you as a smoker when you watched her like that?
It had no effect whatsoever. It just didn't occur to me that any of that would ever happen to me personally, no matter how long I smoked. And I would have continued to smoke. I mean, the only reason that I stopped was I go on these lecture tours twice a year. So 60 nights a year, I'm in a hotel, and all the decent hotels went non-smoking. And when all the Ritz-Carltons went non-smoking, I said, okay, that's it. I have to quit. And I hated to do that. I felt like I'd been forced by if not society, then at least by the Ritz-Carlton people to do it. But I'd never thought of quitting before. So I didn't have a history of trying and failing. So I think that made it a bit easier. But with my mom, like my dad would always say to my sisters and I, like, I can't believe you're still smoking after everything that happened to your mother. Look at you. I can't believe it. And friends of my parents would say the same thing. But I really have to say it had no effect on me at all.
How come? How come it had no effect on you?
Because you just tell yourself that that won't happen to you. I mean, it's just very abstract. I went to a medical examiner's office. I was there for 10 days. I was in the autopsy suite. A pathologist handed me a lung that had belonged to a heavy smoker. He put it in my hands. But that, too, was just abstract. It was like going to a butcher shop and having them hand you a cut of meat that you'd never seen before. Plus, I have my hands full worrying about what the outside of my body looks like. You know, I'm not going to lose sleep over my internal organs. I guess it's mortality. It's the inability to conceive that you are going to die, I suppose.
Now, you're kind of obsessive compulsive, right?
Mm-hmm.
So could you harness that? I mean, I think that feeds into a habit like smoking, because you can smoke obsessively, and it's really hard to give up a habit like that, particularly if you are obsessive compulsive. But is there a part of that obsessive compulsive part of your personality that you could draw on to stop the habit?
No. I had sort of hoped that there was,
yeah.
But it didn't exist. Like the device that would let you not do something over and over and over and over and over and over again. So no, I was sort of felt alone that way. The only thing that I thought would help me would be to tell a lot of people that I was doing it. Plus, I went to Japan to quit. I read in a book that the best way to quit was to move. So I didn't have anything tying me down, and he was free, so we went to Tokyo.
Yeah, so how did it help to change venues?
Because if I told myself in Paris, if I said, okay, from now on, I no longer smoke. Like, I had my last cigarette at midnight, now I'm going to bed, and when I wake up tomorrow, I will no longer be a smoker. Then I would sit at my desk for 2 minutes, and I would say, this is ridiculous. Give me a cigarette. But we rented an apartment in Tokyo, so I had my last cigarette at Charles de Gaulle Airport, got on the plane to Tokyo. You know, getting from the airport to the apartment, getting up to the apartment, speaking to the concierge in my little tiny baby Japanese, that was all an adventure. And everything was so different. I'd never sat at that desk before. I'd never seen such a view before. It just made it easier. Everything else was different, so I thought, okay, well, this can be different too. I don't smoke.
Was part of the deal that you would try to stop smoking and go to Japan so you'd have a great piece to write about stopping smoking in Japan? Did that help?
Well, I went to Japan. I went to the Philippines on a book tour a couple of years ago, and on the way home, I went to Japan. And I'd never really been, I just went because I could, so I could cross it off my country list, right? I was never terribly interested in Japan. I didn't know anything about Japanese food. I just went for a couple days, and it was fantastic. It was the greatest place I'd ever been. And all right, part of that is that I love shopping. I love it. It's my hobby, I think. I'm at my best in front of a cash register. And I thought that in Tokyo it was just going to be like fans and kimonos, and it's not. It's the greatest stuff. It just boggles your mind. And a lot of it, I didn't know what it was, right? And even that didn't stop me. But like all the big department stores have homemade stuffed animal sections. And I'm not like a teddy bear person, but these would be like creatures, like just, I don't know what kind of imagination it would take to invent this kind of thing, but then to sew it on top of it. Even the department store shopping was great. So I went for 3 days and I thought, I've got to come back here one day. So when I thought about quitting, I thought, well, that will be my reward. I mean, I know I want to go somewhere, and I know I want to go somewhere where I'm going to feel like the rug has really been pulled out from under me. So my first thought was going back to Japan.
My guest is David Sedaris, and his new collection is called When You Are Engulfed in Flames. David, I'd like you to do a short reading from the first personal essay in your book, and it's called It's Catching. And this is a short reading. Would you set up where we are in this?
Sure. This is a story about, it begins by talking about sort of a germ phobia, and then it goes on to somehow becomes about Christmas. I don't know how these things work. I finish them sometimes and I think, how the hell did I get there? But this is, I talk about seeing a parrot in a grocery store and about my friend Patsy thinking of germs in a movie theater.
Yeah, so in this piece you talk about how one of your sisters and one of your friends are so germophobic that they won't touch grocery carts because of the germs. They won't lean their head on a seat in a movie theater in case there's, lice on it. They won't, just all kinds of things in public that they just won't touch because of the germs. And that leads you to these thoughts.
The only preventive thing I do is wash clothes after buying them in a thrift shop. This after catching crabs from a pair of used pants. I was in my mid-20s at the time, and probably would have itched myself all the way to the bone had a friend not taken me to a drugstore, where I got a bottle of something called Quell. After applying it, I raked through my pubic hair with a special knit comb, and what I came away with was a real eye-opener. These little monsters who'd been feasting for weeks on my flesh. I guess they're what Patsy imagines when she looks at a theater seat, what Lisa sees lurking on the handle of a grocery cart. They're minor, though, compared to what Hugh had. He was 8 years old and living in the Congo when he noticed a red spot on his leg. Nothing huge. Mosquito bite, he figured. The following day, the spot became more painful, and the day after that, he looked down and saw a worm poking out.
That was so horrifying, David, when I read it.
<It's> just, and his
it's
mom
such a
had
horrible
one.
Image. And his mom had one, too. Yeah. It just is the perfect image for me about how, you know, the human body could be so beautiful, but there are times when it could just be just like so horrible. Like, did you recoil in horror when you saw that?
When he told me about the worm, then I thought, oh, my God, I've kissed this person. But when he told me that his mother had a worm like that, too. I mean, if I saw a worm crawling out of my mother's leg, I would have just marched to the nearest orphanage and said, take me. I would have burned everything she'd ever given me, all pictures of herself, because that's somehow worse than having a worm in your own leg, is having a worm in your mother's leg. I mean, if her leg was wooden and it was a termite in there, even that would be bad. But a worm, a real worm in a flesh leg, that's repellent. But they lived in Africa, and such things happened.
Are you squeamish about your body or about bodies in general?
I have this book called Medico-Legal Investigations of Death, and it's pictures of every possible way that you could die. Like, this is what you would look like if you were run over by a truck. This is what you would look like if you were run over by a tractor. This is what you would look like if you were run over by a tractor and then dumped in a creek for 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. No problem with books like that. I went to the medical examiner's office and I was there for a week. And I think part of what bothered me there was the smell. You know, that took a little bit of getting used to. But with my own body, I can't bear any of that. Cannot bear any of it. When sometimes you'll see in pictures, you'll see somebody with a goiter, right? The size of a the size of a beach ball, right? And you think, how on earth did that person allow it to get to that point? I would. I would just tell myself, it'll go away. It'll go away. I'll get a turtleneck. It'll go away.
You had one of the more famous boils in in American history because you got this boil on your behind that coincided with your book tour and your appearance at the American Booksellers Association convention a few years ago. And this is like the big book convention, and it was the launch of your book tour. And I remember being on a panel with you at breakfast where you talked about the boil. And it was kind of funny timing to talk about it. And we talked about that a little bit when you were on the show back in 2004. But in your new book, you write about that a little bit, and you write about how you asked your boyfriend Hugh to lance it for you eventually. And when he did, you write about how horrible the stuff that came out of it was, how it smelled like evil, and that this evil had been trapped in your body. And I just would like you to reflect on how it felt at that moment, feeling that you had been the host to this stuff.
Well, it was my second time when I realized that I was a host to really what had to be like the foulest liquid on Earth. I mean, it was more horrible than anything, smell-wise. But a couple of years ago, Hugh did lead me to the dentist who led me to a periodontist, and the periodontist cut my gums from top to bottom, and then he lifted them up, and he scraped that very same thing from the roots of my teeth. It smelled just like that. And I couldn't feel a thing because he had shot me full of Novocaine. So it was this odd sensation. I saw him, you know, sticking a knife into my mouth, and I saw his hand going back and forth, and I knew that and I could taste blood, and I knew that there was stuff going on in there. But it wasn't until I smelled it, and then I just said, uh-huh. And what I was saying is, I'm sorry. I was so sorry that I subjected anybody. It must have cleared the building. And to know that was just there, hidden beneath my gum line. And this boil, maybe there was a bit of it here, a bit of it there in my body, and it said, let's all meet on the tailbone. I don't know how that worked. But it really, I wrote a story about Hugh Lansing, the boil, and it sort of turned into a love story in a way.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Because the fact that anyone would do that for you. And he would never lance to boil in his life, but he can do anything. He really can. Like if you said, we need to build a flood's coming. We need to build a dike out of these big stones. He's never built a dike before, but he could. He could do it if he set his mind to it. He would mix the cement and you'd have yourself a dike and it would be the best dike around. He can do anything. And he lanced my boil. And this came at the end of a sort of a long essay about fidelity. And really that at the end of the day, that's sort of what it's all about, you know, is finding somebody who will lance your boil.
Yeah, when you get to the point in a relationship where your lover can do that for you or your spouse can do that for you and not feel like they can never touch you again. Seriously, right?
Right. Well, it helps if they had a worm in their leg.
That's true.
You know, because then you think, okay, well, how bad is my boil really? You had worms living inside
of you.
But
you didn't see the worm, whereas he saw your boil.
But I think there was something about being on an airplane that gave the boil more confidence. I don't know if it was something about the altitude, but because actually the boil came back after I was on an airplane. And so then I went to a clinic in London, and then they relanced it. And so, I haven't heard anything from it since then.
Good. So do you basically see the body as being beautiful or being like frightening and you know, like on that sliding scale, how often do you see like the human body as beautiful and wonderful and charming and arousing and all of that? And how much time do you see it as just kind of potentially repulsive?
Well,
you
know,
is that
a weird
question to ask?
No, I started swimming, and so I started seeing people in their bathing suits, right? And I'm amazed now. The older I get, I'm amazed. I'll see like a 14-year-old, and I don't mean that I see them in a sexual way, but you look at them and it's like seeing like an antelope or something, and just their bodies at that age. There's something just magnificent. Like if I were going to send some bodies into space, like to show other creatures what we're capable of, I'd probably take a couple of 14-year-olds, right? But after that, the body becomes a science project to me. Actually, no, I'd say like at 48, then it becomes like a science project. So it's fascinating, but in a completely different way. Like I'll see somebody who's, I don't know, my age or anywhere my age and older, and I find that body just as fascinating.
Let me just ask you one more body question. Do you have dreams, like weird body dreams in which, say, part of your scalp has fallen out or, you sneeze and your teeth come out or, you know, those weird classic body dreams that are very like surreal and upsetting or like your fingernail falls off or.
I have a lot of dreams in which my teeth fall out, but never when I sneeze. I love that idea that you would not only lose your teeth, that you would actually spit them onto somebody else. We have a friend in Normandy, and she went to the dentist last year. And my understanding is that it was just a regular dental appointment. And he pulled out a pair of pliers, and he ripped every single tooth out of her head.
Oh, my God.
And she had a vacation. She had made vacation plans, and they weren't going to have her dentures ready for 10 days. But she thought, well, I made these plans, and I don't want to lose that money. So she went on vacation.
Oh, God.
To a resort town in Brittany without a tooth in her head. And that, to me, was proof that nightmares really can come true. Because I've dreamt that exact same thing. I don't dream that I'm paralyzed too often. Sometimes I'll dream that I grew an appendage. Not anything is easy to remove as a tail or a third arm, but just, you know, like sort of something tail-like that would just come out of my shoulder, you know, it just comes out of the wrong place.
You write in your book, "I never cheated on a boyfriend. It's become part of my idea of myself." Here's what I'm wondering. This is a weird question, but I have this theory, and I'd like to know what you think of it. That if you're obsessive compulsive, when it comes to relationships, you're likely to be a kind of sex addict type, or really monogamous, because you know your compulsion can lead you to just have as much sex as you can with as many people as possible, or to really appreciate the appreciate monogamy for its dedication and its patterns, its predictable patterns, and find that very fulfilling.
Well, I would float a third theory.
Yeah.
And that is that I'm ugly. And like no one wants to have sex. Nobody wants to have sex with me. So that makes it a lot easier. When no one's asking you to cheat on your boyfriend, it becomes so much easier.
Oh, that
not
just can't be.
Cheat.
I mean, that maybe you might have felt that way about yourself once, but that can't be. You're much too famous and talented and beloved to not have.
But nobody, people have asked me that. Yeah. They've said, "Oh, well, don't people come up to you on your book tour?" Never. Never. Well, okay, one time this guy sort of waited for me after the reading, and I ran into the waiting car. I don't, even when I have dreams in which I meet somebody else, I can never get to the sex part because I start thinking, what would I say to Hugh? Because I would lose everything. And I just can't imagine really at this point what would possibly make it worth it. Because I suppose the more you have to lose, you know, the harder you think about things like that.
You know, because of stories like the story of James Fry and Margaret Jones, people who'd written things that they called memoirs that were actually not true, there's been a lot more scrutiny about, you know, personal essays and memoirs. There's even a piece in the New Republic that fact-checked some of your stories and just suggested there were a few exaggerations in early pieces and things that other people who were there didn't see the same way you saw it. Have standards changed now when it comes to, like, publishing personal essays or memoirs because of all the stuff that's, you know, that's out there that's been proven not to be true? Like, when you're published in The New Yorker and it's a personal essay, is there, like, fact-checking for that as if it were a repertorial piece?
The fact-checking is at The New Yorker has always been really intense. I had written in a story, I said that I talked about a painting that I bought, and I said that it cost as much as the average person pays for car insurance. It was just a throwaway line, right? I didn't want to give the exact price because I didn't want to put people off. So I said that costs as much as the person pays for car insurance. So the fact-checker said, "Well, how much did the painting cost?" And I told him, and he said, "That's more than the average person pays." And I said, "Okay, the average epileptic." And hung up the phone, and he calls back, and he said, "You'd have to change that to the average epileptic in Connecticut because they have the highest insurance rates for drivers." But it wasn't really a story about that, right? So I said, okay, it costs as much as the average bumper pool table. And then he called and said, "Actually, bumper pool tables are a lot less than you might think. You're going to have to change that to a high-end bumper pool table." And I said, "Pool table. Just say pool table." I mean, and this was for a line that I'd considered a throwaway line. You know, I had another story about a clock in my dad's dining room, and I had said that it was, I don't know, walnut. So the fact checker called, and apparently the clock was cherry. So that's fine. And I changed to cherry. But pretty much, I would say that my pieces are fact-checked the same way that a reported piece is.
Is it making you feel more inhibited as a writer?
I think that there. I feel like I've always been pretty upfront about the way that I write. You know, I exaggerate. I've written about how much I exaggerate. I exaggerate about how much I exaggerate. And then it seemed like to me that all of a sudden the rules changed. You know, I mean, for a humorist, I always thought that you were allowed to do that. Like if somebody nags, in my writing, they nag, 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 right? So I'm not inventing the fact that they nag. I'm just turning up the volume on it a little bit.
Just one last question. I saw you on The Daily Show. You were great. And I was thinking, okay, I was trying to put myself in your shoes, and I was thinking, okay, the most self-conscious part would be walking out to the chair with Jon Stewart. Where, like, you're walking out, and you know that the camera's on you. Was that awkward?
The thing about going on a television show like that is I always feel like the people in the audience, they have every right to expect that somebody really big is going to be on, right? And then it's like you, and they haven't really heard of you, and so they have to get over their disappointment, and at the same time you have to worry about what you look like. But I have to say, Jon Stewart makes it so easy, and he comes into the dressing room beforehand, so you actually get to see him, you know, before, because it's frightening, because when you go on television, you have as much makeup on as a corpse, basically. So when you go on television, all of a sudden you're talking to someone and he looks like a corpse and you think, oh, I must look like one too. I must look like one too. But he made it super easy, and he wants people to be relaxed. His thing is, we're just going to get out there and talk, and it doesn't really matter, and we'll just have fun, and, you know, don't even think it'll be over before you know it. And he was exactly right.
David Sedaris, it's great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
David Sedaris' new book is called When You Are Engulfed in Flames. The movie Control, based on the life of Ian Curtis, the lead singer of the band Joy Division, didn't play in theaters for long when it was released last year, but now you have a second chance because it's out on DVD. So we invited the director, Anton Corbijn, to talk with us. Joy Division was a short-lived but influential British post-punk band. Ian Curtis, the lead singer, killed himself in 1980 at the age of 23. Corbijn became a Joy Division fan after hearing their first album in Holland, where he's from. His love of their music led him to England, where he ended up taking now-famous photos of the band. Corbijn went on to create the visual image of many other bands, including U2 and Depeche Mode, through his album cover photos and rock videos. In a review of Control in the New York Times, film critic A.O. Scott wrote, "You don't have to know anything about Joy Division to grasp the mysterious sorrow at its heart." Here's Joy Division's best-known recording, "Love Will Tear Us Apart." That's the band Joy Division. In the film Control, the lead singer Ian Curtis is played by Sam Riley. Here he is toward the end of the film, just before the band is about to embark on what was to be its first U.S. tour, a tour that never happened because of Curtis's suicide.
I don't want to be in the band anymore. Unknown Pleasures was it. I was happy. I never meant for it to grow like this. When I'm up there, singing, they don't understand how much I give and how it affects me.
Panic's over. He's here.
And now they want more. They expect me to give more.
Just enjoy yourself.
and I don't know if I can. It's like it's not happening to me, but someone pretending to be me. Someone dressed in my skin. And now we're going to America. I've no control anymore. I don't know what to do.
Anton Corbijn, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you decide to make the movie Control? You'd liked Joy Division for a long time. You'd taken pictures of them. Some of those pictures had become pretty famous. Why did you want to make the film?
Well, I initially didn't want to make the film, I should say, because in some countries people describe my work as being that of a rock photographer, which I kind of understand, but I am not a rock photographer. I'm a photographer who does portraits, and a lot of these portraits are musicians, but it's generally artists that I like. But because of that, I was afraid that if I would do a movie that connects to the music world, it might be called a rock film, and that would severely limit my audience. And I was approaching 50, and I had felt for a while that it was a little weird for somebody my age to still work from obsessions from his teenage years. So I wanted to, in a way, cap that off, and I felt that the movie might be a really good way to make an end to that whole period of teenage obsessions, and at the same time maybe make a new start, which is working a bit more in film.
Well, I like what you just said about wanting to go back one more time to your teenage obsessions and then put it behind you. But you were around 50 when you made Control, as opposed mm-hmm. to being a young man, which is what you were when you first photographed Joy Division. Do you feel like you didn't understand then how troubled he was, and how it wasn't just artistry that was being communicated when he seemed to be lonely and in pain on stage? He really was in a great deal of pain.
I didn't realize that, no. And I don't think a lot of the others really realized that. There's this quote that I read recently from, I'm not sure if it was Bernard or Hookie, but
the bass player in the band.
Yes, the bass player or the guitar player. That after Ian died, they went reading the lyrics and they realized what the lyrics were actually about. They never really listened to them. They was just thinking, well, that's Ian's kind of cup of tea, you know, the lyrics. If people who were so close to him didn't all realize what was really, really happening to him, then, you know, somebody like me who spoke the language a little and didn't really know him, there was no way that I would have realized that.
Now, when you're making a music film about a famous band, you have to decide whether you're going to use the band's actual recordings and have the musicians in the film lip sync, or whether you're going to let the musicians actually perform the music and then risk that they will be compared unfavorably to how the band actually sounded. How did you decide to let the actors perform? And I have to say, they do a really good job.
I totally agree with you. They do an excellent job. Well, I didn't have to persuade them. They had to persuade me, to be fair to them. I never thought I would find actors that could play to that level. Because I was looking for actors, not musicians, to play the roles. And I did want them to play in the film to a degree that it looked believable on film. They needed some lessons, of course, to make that look correct. And during these rehearsals to learn those songs, they became so enthused that they kept rehearsing even in weekends. And by the time we were ready to film the first performance, they begged me to try it for real. And we did, and then that was so good there was no way back. It was an incredible bonus to the film that the actors were so dedicated to the characters they played. And then, of course, Sam Riley had been a singer for 6 years, so I couldn't be happier that it fell into place as much as that. And the manager of New Order came to look at the rehearsals, and she felt they were maybe even better than Joy Division by that stage. You have to realize that Joy Division, of course, were, you know, post-punk band. So it was the period where everybody just went for things, though they might not be able to play properly. They played whatever they could play and learned on stage. And that was all acceptable in those days. But the guys learned to play to that level, and that is apparently doable. You know, I wouldn't be able to copy that, but they learned it all in about 4 weeks, or maybe even less, 3 weeks.
Let's play a track from the soundtrack recording of Control, and this is the only track that actually features the actors performing. Mm-hmm. And this is one of Joy Division's more famous songs, Transmission, and we'll hear it introduced by the character of Tony Wilson, who was the presenter of a music show on Granada TV in England, and put Joy Division on TV for the first time. So first we'll hear the introduction, and then we'll hear the actors performing as Joy Division with Sam Riley as Ian Curtis.
Seeing as how this is the first television program which brought you the first appearances from everyone from the Beatles to the Buzzcocks, we like to think we bring you the most new and interesting sounds in the Northwest. They're called Joy Division, and are a Manchester band except for the guitarist who comes from Salford. A very important distinction. This is called Transmission.
Actors from the movie Control performing a song by Joy Division, and Control is about the band Joy Division. It stars Sam Riley as the band's lead singer and songwriter Ian Curtis. My guest Anton Corbijn directed the movie, and it's just come out on DVD. I think we should describe Ian Curtis's performance style when he was on stage, and you know, judging from the movie, he kind of like almost punches the air as he sings, and it's kind of like part boxer, part dancer. He looks like somebody who's very inhibited, being very uninhibited when he's on stage.
Yeah, he's a bit like a kickboxing butterfly or something. You know, we had to study, of course, the movements really well, and you realize he stands a lot on his toes. It's a very peculiar thing to do, and it's not symmetric, his moves. You know, it's really very difficult to copy properly, and maybe some of the, you know, moves that he had when he had epilepsy or epileptic attacks are incorporated in the end into it. I'm not really sure.
And I think what you're referring to is that there's this almost like jerky side to side motion that he does.
That's right. Yes. I personally have seen a gig by Joy Division where the dancing became an epileptic fit, and he fell backwards onto the drum kits, which a similar scene is actually performed in the film.
Now, Ian Curtis got epilepsy, and the way you portray it, he gets his first seizure in a car on the road with the band after complaining mm-hmm. that he's very cold. And when the seizure starts, the way it's portrayed in the film, The members of the band have no idea what's happening, and it takes them a while to realize he's having a seizure, and they'd better pull over and tend to him. Is that the way it happened?
I believe so, yes. I don't think anybody had much of a clue about these things, you know. Ian more than the others, because he worked in daytime in an office trying to find work for people who were slightly physically handicapped. And that included people with epilepsy.
So he knew something about epilepsy, but he didn't realize he was going to get it.
Yes.
His widow, Deborah, in her memoir writes that after he started taking the medication for the epilepsy, the mood swings became even worse. She writes, after a gig, he wouldn't go to sleep until he'd had a fit, and it became a ritual for him to sit there and wait for an attack. He was afraid to go to sleep in case he died in his sleep. My guest is Anton Corbijn, director of the film Control, which has just come out on DVD. It's based on the life of Ian Curtis, the lead singer of the post-punk band Joy Division. Curtis killed himself in 1980. Your film Control is shot in black and white. So were the photos that you took of Joy Division when you photographed the band.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to shoot the movie in black and white?
Well, purely because everything you remember of Ian Curtis and of Joy Division is in black and white. The reason I photographed them in black and white was not only because it was my favorite way of taking photographs, and I was very bad at color pictures anyway, but it was also because in those days you shot, of course, with film, which I actually still do, I like to say, and the only people or magazines that were interested in publishing anything on Joy Division were all printed in black and white. So consequently, every photographer that ever shot Joy Division would put a black and white film in the camera, because that was the only way they could sell a photograph. It was not till Ian's death, when they had a hit with Love Will Tear Us Apart, that the color magazines, which was a very different world at the time than black and white magazines, were getting interested in Joy Division. But then, of course, nobody had a color picture of Joy Division. So for that reason, not because of my own aesthetics, but for that reason, I felt black and white was the correct way to shoot this film. Even their own output, the two albums, Closer and Unknown Pleasures, were black and white images.
So in shooting black and white, was there anything special you did to get the black and white tones that you wanted?
Well, it doesn't look like my photography, although the blacks do, and I always like very deep blacks in my photography. But I never use lights, and of course in the film we did lighting, so for me it looks quite different than my photography. We shot in color because the black and white films that exist didn't give us a lot of option. They were very, very grainy, and it's one thing to have grain in a still photograph, but if you have grain on film, it just becomes another element where you have to deal with when you look at the film. So we went for color shooting and then transferred it to black and white.
Well, you went on to take photographs of a lot of bands, do a lot of videos, a lot of album covers,
mm-hmm.
Metallica, U2, Bryan Adams, Johnny Cash's Delia's Gone video.
Nick Cave.
Nick Cave, yeah.
Depeche Mode, I did 20 videos for, I know.
You know, it's funny, album jackets shrunk when CDs took over and replaced vinyl. And now that downloads are taking over from CDs, I mean, you know, you can choose to download the cover art or you could choose to not bother, but
it's still not
the same. And, you know, videos certainly don't have the prominent place that they used to, even on MTV. So do you feel like the visual part of music that you professionally came of age with is disappearing?
Well, it's definitely different. And you know, I'm old-fashioned, I think. You know, I'm romantic because I still like vinyl more and more so. I like the sound of it. I like the look of it. I like the way you open an album, everything about it. And you can see that actually in the first scene in Control, where Ian comes home having bought A Lad Insane by David Bowie. And that's the event of the week. You know, you come home with your record, you go to the bedroom at your parents' place, you take the record out of the bag and you look at it, you read everything. It all has a meaning, you know. It was something that gave meaning to life. Now, of course, for young kids, there is so much else to do and everything is available at all times. You know, it doesn't have that same meaning in life anymore. And I realize that it's changed.
Do you have a favorite of the album jackets that you've done? I know doing album jackets hasn't been your favorite thing, but you've done your share.
Yeah, no, I'm proud of some. I'm happy to say, but I did well over 100, I'm sure, 150 or so. But some, of course, brought my work to many more places, and one of those was definitely the Joshua Tree by U2, as was Achtung Baby. I think they were quite significant album sleeves for me. The Depeche Mode albums I also design, and I do the I make the logos and all these things. So they're important for me as well as a place to play and try things. And so there's a couple there that I like a lot.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Anton Corbijn directed the film Control. It's just come out on DVD. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Hurdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.